This is DNFM. I'm Sam Solomon. DNFM features the latest stories in design and tech brought to you by Designer News. This is episode 10. I would wager that today's guest is somebody who's sent you an email at one time or another. If you haven't guessed it, today's guest is Envision CEO Clark Valberg. And that for those of you who don't know, Envision is a prototyping platform for designers. But we're going to talk a bit with Clark about Envision's past, present, and the future. First, we've got a word from our sponsor and a few announcements. This episode of DNFM is sponsored by Peel. Peel is the original and best ultra-thin iPhone case. It's designed to keep the original look of your iPhone while still protecting it. And as a bonus, it's branding free. Peel has cases for the iPhone 7, the 6, the 5, and even iPads. So if you've purchased a new iPhone, head to buypeel.com and protect it with a super thin case from Peel today. When you check out, remember to use offer code DN7 for 10% off your order. Again, that's DN and the number 7. Once again, a big thanks to the team at Peel for sponsoring this episode. No announcements today, but we do have a handful of featured job listings. Rector is looking for a senior UX designer and a senior product designer in New York. Mono is looking for a user interface designer in Belgium. Close.io is looking for a product designer, and that's a remote job. Memebox is looking for a senior product designer in San Francisco. If you're looking for a new career, a new gig, you can find all of these listings and more at designernews.co/jobs. Okay, let's get to the interview. All right. My guest, Clark Valberg, is the founder and CEO of Envision, which is a prototyping and collaboration platform for designers. Clark, it's great to have you on the show.
It's so good to be here. Big fan of the show, big fan of the Designer News audience, big fan of you. You already knew that.
So, you know, to start off, Tobias Van Schneider, who's one of the most well-known designers in the industry, well-respected.
Never heard of him.
He's been making memes about and videos about you and your emails. I mean, that must be an absolute fantastic honor.
I feel like they've died down. I feel like I liked when I was a one meme a week kind of guy. I feel like that's a certain level of celebrity in our industry. I feel like now it's like one meme a month. A fiscal quarter. We need to kick it back up.
You know what the solution of that is, Clark?
More emails. Send more emails.
You know what made my day was when I saw the top comment on his YouTube video was your "I'm Clark and I approve this message" comment.
I do. He is number one, a fantastic, you know, friend of the company, and just like a super awesome, creative, funny guy, and one of those multi-dimensional creatives, making memes, designing what, you know, stuff like Spotify and other stuff. So that's what's not to love.
Yeah, and you know, I think part of the thing with the memes is if you're working with people, obviously there's a lot of creatives who know who you are and people work in the creative industry. Photoshop and a new meme is just like a couple of clicks away. So
that's true. The low production value has decreased the level of intentionality required to burn someone online.
Well, no, in all seriousness, I think you guys do a great job at marketing, whether it be the Clark from Envision emails or in my inbox or the guides or you know, the stickers, the wireframe kits. You guys, you know, do so much. What, you know, what do you think is one of those stuck out in your mind as something that's worked better than all of the others?
The definition of worked is weird. Like, we don't have super duper, like, a super duper scientific way of calculating ROI for all of these things. For some of them we do, like for our core activities we do. But when you say works well, I think about what are the things that our customers, would-be customers, what are the things that designers love the most? And love is also, this is also a definite, like what things they download the most could be one way to define that. What things they talk about the most, what things they send me the most thank you emails about.
You could choose, if you could choose one of the things you've done, what would that be?
I I'm most excited right now, because I'm the person who, you know, my excitement, you know, changes over time about different things we're working on, but I'm most excited now about Design Disruptors. So we did this, you know, people here probably have heard of it at least once before in their entire lives. But we interviewed like 70 design leaders at, you know, all these great companies. We start off with our customers, and we just started filming. We started filming and understanding why they do what they do and how they do what they do. And that, it just evolved into this movie. I think it is like officially, Sam, like a feature-length film. By the way, I had to Google that to figure out how long that actually is. I think it's like an hour and 45 minutes or something. Everyone's going to Google this now, but I think it's true. But I think, no, maybe an hour and 20 minutes. There's a definition of feature length. You can't just go calling your commercial a feature length movie. It has to be a thing. And we have literally hundreds of hours of video that we're going to find other ways, very interesting creative ways to use over time. But so the movie was really exciting for me. It was a great way to tell our customer stories back to the world, to our customers, those who would be customers, and of course, you know, the broader business ecosystem, to help them better understand the evolution of the design industry. There's an old adage: you can tell a good thing because good things come from that thing, right? They're good derivatives, right? So we have these community showings that are happening around the globe. I think we have, at current, 500, you know, mini premieres of the Design Disruptors film someplace in the world. There are like probably 4 going on in Bangkok right now.
Clark, that's got to be a giant organizational undertaking. How are you guys doing that?
I do it all myself. I do it myself and I do it live. Okay. No, it actually requires absolutely no work whatsoever on our part. When people sign up to do a premiere, they give us like some, you know, very minimal amount of information of where they want to do it and how many people are going to show up. And we just give them all the tools, all the resources in the film to make it happen on their own. These are totally 100% community driven. We don't market to them, you know, in any like, you know, oppressive way. We don't like send signage that they have to display or anything like that. They just run these things on their own. And they're happening. Also, we've created some great partnerships with people like General Assembly. I think General Assembly is running film little mini premieres in, like, I don't know, more than 20 different campuses around the world. I just made that number up. I have no idea how many it is, but it's a lot. You know, IBM, I think, is running a whole bunch of campus premieres. That's been really exciting. It's been exciting just because I like things that are big enough to get away from you, big enough to kind of just take on a life of their own. And, you know, being authentic and trying to both capture and be part of the voice of our customer depends on the things that we do being able to do that at some point.
I want to get back to telling customer stories, because I think that's something you guys have done a really good job of for a long time. But like in the scheme of things, like when you hear people talk about like content marketing and things like that, you kind of think of just an ebook. I mean, this really is something that is above and beyond putting out an hour and 40 minute or whatever it is film. Where did that idea come from?
Okay, my broader thesis on content marketing could be described as, and has often been described as, cookies, kittens, and crack. Right? All of our marketing fits into one of those categories. The cookies are things that are plentiful, things that you can bake up sheets of, things that, you know, that everybody basically, they're universally appreciated, and, you know, there are a few people in the world who argue with a nice, fresh, hot chocolate chip cookie, right? Those are our blog posts. We are very focused on providing a very high bar of quality on the kind of content that we put out, and putting out a lot of it. And we have more than 2-point-something million subscribers who get that Clark from Envision email every week. And so the engagement is just like insane, like hundreds of thousands of, you know, unique visitors click and go and read and share, and it's great. The kittens are fluffier, cuddlier, more expensive to produce. Those who love kittens love them even more than they love cookies, right? That's our gated content. You think about the ebooks, and you think about the, you know, the courses and the downloadables of every kind, the templates. These things are take up, like, it is an incredible amount of time goes into making like one ebook or one Photoshop sketch template thingy. But, you know, again, universally appreciated, and it's something that people can really, it becomes part of their work. There's a durability to it. and then crack. The Envision movie, the Design Disruptors movie, definitely falls into that category. These are moonshots that are quasi-irrational in terms of their purpose as a marketing vehicle, but are exciting enough to get people talking. Now, figuring out ways to make that benefit the brand, I will tell you, for us, has always been a little bit of an afterthought, right? I know that we're lauded as being, you know, sharp on the marketing stuff. We are sharp on, particularly sharp on making things that people really love. And we rely, and I think that, by the way, I think the law, this new emerging philosophy of, you know, authentic customer voice requires that you allow the customer to find you.
I mean, because you guys are making something cool, they're like, I've got to see what these Envision, what this Envision company is doing. They must have a bunch of other cool stuff.
This is the love wins principle of marketing.
So I said I wanted to come back to customers and telling your customer stories. You guys have been doing this Inside Design series for a long time, I believe. I think it was your first kind of content marketing, right?
That's true.
When you were doing Inside Design, were those companies already customers? Were those, you know, potential clients you were courting?
Yeah, so they were customers. So there's a funny story behind this. We had our lead designer at that time had a brother who lived in the Bay Area. His name was Gavin. His name is probably still on some of those early ones. And he fancied himself a semi-professional photographer. And he was like, hey, you guys got any photography work for me? I'm like, we don't really have an office. You know, now we have offices, but like many people know that Envision is, you know, largely a remote distributed company. And I have all the glam shots of myself that I need at the moment. But how about just going out and meeting customers and taking photos of them, right? So it really started with just go out and take photos of our customers and collect quotes. And then that kind of evolved into, hey, by the way, why don't you just interview them while you're there? And I think like the first like order of business was like, find out like what's on their desk. Because people like, I think it was actually called, before it was called Inside Design, I think it was called Design Spaces, I think it was the first like iteration of that. And it was just like, let's look at their desk, see all the cool chashka on their desk. And then I think in some of the early ones, you'll see we actually call out the chashka, like this person uses this kind of pen, which you can click and buy on Amazon now, right? This person has this book on their desk all the time, right? Here's the mug, right? And so it started off with just go meet customers, take photos, and then let's try to create like some really fun content out of what it's like to be them.
Everyone who's listening to the show knows, knows what you guys do. Everyone knows who Envision is, but I'm not sure that everyone who's listening to the show kind of knows your story, knows how you guys started. And I know when we talked several years ago, when we first met, you know, you told me about how in, you know, you guys were born out of a creative agency, Epicenter, right?
Yeah, that's right. I'm the co-founder of Envision, by the way. I selfishly allow myself to be called the founder, but I have a co-founder. His name is Ben. So Ben and I ran a creative agency in New York called Epicenter. And we built the Envision product with absolutely no intention whatsoever to make this available to anyone but our own customers. Like, so much so that when someone recommended, hey, why don't you guys turn this into like a SaaS product? This is like 5.5 years ago when like it wasn't a foregone conclusion that you would turn like any calculator app you made into a SaaS product and sell for $10 a month. This idea of, hey, taking a thing that you built for yourself and turning it into a business wasn't fashion. It was pre that era. And we were super resistant to it. We were like, no, this is a tool for consulting, and this is going to make our consulting business so much better. And you know, our customer. So the thing that it did for our customers is it totally changed the relationship dynamic. It's all too common in the world. Was I think the tides have shifted since then, but it's all too common that consultants and their clients end up on opposite ends of the table, and opposite sides. And end up fighting over requirements and end up fighting about scope, and scope creep becomes the enemy that, you know, destroys the relationship, right, ultimately. And we wanted to figure out a way to fix the relationship problem and to create an entirely different kind of relationship with our customers, with our clients. We said, this is like a longer story than you probably want to hear, but how do we embrace scope creep? So I have a friend of mine, his name is Hal. He wrote this whole article, I think, for List Apart. You can probably find it online. It's called In Defense of Scope Creep. So I read this. I became addicted to this idea. how can we build something that looks like the finished product, show it to our customers, get feedback super early, super often, and build consensus instead of building to spec. And that idea was so provocative because it also allowed us to have relationships in a much broader with a much broader set of stakeholders with our clients. So instead of just like, oh, it's us, this delegatory model of communication, it's us and the project manager, and us and the one person who's in charge of the opinion of 150 other people who have to use this software on a day-to-day basis and 1,000 customers. We were building really complex like business software for the most part. How do we get more surface area on that insight? How do we actually make contact and get feedback and insight from all of the people who are going to use this and customers who represent, you know, archetypal customers who represent ultimately the people who will define success of this product down the line? How do we meet them, get their feedback, show them something real instead of just have these abstract conversations and pull out charts and write up docs, right? How do we show them something real and get real feedback early? Fine, it's almost silly to say now because 5 years later, this is nothing new and most great software products are created as, you know, the result of a process that really looks more like this than anything else. But that was very provocative and we knew we had to build prototypes and we knew that we started off building prototypes with code. This is a whole big story. With code, that didn't work because at some point, like the complexity of web applications shifted from the back end to the front end. And so the code you have to write to make something, you know, to make a front end, it's obviously the pre-Framer days and things like that. But the code you have to write to make a really good code-based prototype just ended up, you know, having its own, you know, layers of abstraction and complexity and things like that. So we said, hey, what if we just took like Photoshop screens and linked them together?
Is that really like what you guys were doing?
Oh yeah, 100%. So we said, how do we use image maps? Like, you remember image maps?
Was that like a Dreamweaver, like Linkem?
So Dreamweaver had an interface to make them. Like,
okay, that's what I remember.
But it's an HTML construct, right? You can say from this coordinate to this coordinate, you know, you can like define coordinates in HTML, and you can define a piece of a image to then be clickable as a href, right?
That's interesting. So before you guys were around, I was actually linking PDFs, putting a bunch of PDFs in a folder. This was like 2010 with my first company, and that's how I was doing that.
By the way, that's a really good way of doing it. I didn't like the PDF thing because it tended to distort the design. Like it was very difficult to get PDFs to show at like 100% size and clarity and fidelity for all the people who opened it. So we needed to be in a browser. It needed to be like just images so that we could iterate really rapidly. I think we actually didn't use Photoshop. I think we all used Fireworks at that time. Remember Fireworks? Like we were all super Fireworks dudes. And we did image maps. And then my business partner, Ben Nadell, who, you know, still in Vision, still doing his thing. He said, hey, I can actually build a little app that does this. And I'm like, sure. But, you know, if you think we're going to make this into a company, don't bug me about making this into its own company.
you thought you were solving a problem for your agency. Like this was something that was going to be for the agency.
I would love to tell you that I am this like visionary who said, this is the future of design. I had no such thoughts at the time, right? I said, this is going to be great for our customers. This is going to be great for... Yeah, I was just focused on the relationships and making the relationships we had already even better. He said, sure, he did it. Like, I think after using it with like one incremental, you know, one additional project or customer, whatever, we were like, wow, this is really something. And we rolled it out, made it available to the world, and it kind of like took off from there.
So you guys really had no intention of, you know, I feel like there's a lot of agencies that like we're really a product company that kind of is just doing agency work.
Because it's fashionable now and people understand that, by the way, it's a really good, you know, revenue model in terms of investing, you know, your human resources into potential.
Well, it's hard. I mean, I think it's hard to do. A lot of agencies try and do that, but, you know, that's really hard to do.
It is hard. I think it is really important that they, you know, take that on as a discipline. I think there are a lot of organizational benefits to doing that. Even if you will never be successful with a single product ever, there are benefits to having your team work on a product and helping your team be able to take something through its courses, full stack, end to end, to market. Even if the whole thing is a big flop, and there are a lot of companies that have products, and you know, I'm sure that if you look back in the graveyard of our agency, there were things that we, you know, whatever, right?
Clark, why is that important?
if a company's doing agency work, wouldn't they just continue doing agency work? Why would they want to work on products?
So when you're an agency, it is easy to default, and I'm not saying this about any particular agency, it's easy to default into requirements-driven tunnel vision. Your clients tell you what they want, and you know it's descriptive, and you build the thing that they want, and you hope that the contract covers you when you deliver this thing, whether it's good or not, because this is exactly what they asked for, right? There are those agencies, right? And there are agencies that are much more consultative, if that's a word, you know, where the client tells them what they want and they say, oh, I think you want that because of A, B, and C. Here's something that's totally different than what you asked for, but actually solves your problem better. You can do that as an agency. It's risky to do that as an agency. People sometimes, you know, you have clients who don't know necessarily what's best for them and you end up giving them something that's different than what they asked for and they freak out even though you're right. When you build your own product, you have to use those creative muscles, right? There is no one telling you, other than your customers, and by the way, you have none of those to begin with, and other than your own, you know, intuition, and that obviously is being refined over time, there's no one telling you what to do. You have to discover the solution on your own, right? And you have to be willing to iterate, and you have to be willing to be wrong, and you have to be willing to engage. There are just a whole bunch of muscles that you don't necessarily work, I don't want to make these super black and white statements, that it is very easy not to work when you are working for clients.
You know, to me, just coming from the agency world, it's hard because, you know, it's really the client that's iterating. Like there's certain milestones you have to hit. And, you know, in the product world, that's, you know, maybe not necessarily true. You're really trying to figure out, you know, how far away is this customer is from buying or using my product or doing something
else. It's a process of curation. Like, you know, when you have your own product, it has to be, for it to be successful, it must be a process of curation as opposed to production. Right? Production begins with an end in mind, a very specific end, and you go through all the, you know, all the different courses and people and workflows, you know, required to produce that specific end. All right, curation starts with an assumption, some ideas, some creative stuff, and tries to get something out to the world that meets those needs. And then, you know, any good business today, and this, by the way, is a broader conversation about, I think, you know, how the production models of software have shifted over time and how the best companies in the world think versus everyone else. And this is a lot of the stuff we've discovered in shooting this film. The best companies in the world work in a cycle that looks kind of like constantly understanding their customer better, right? And there are many instruments that they use to do this, you know, qualitative, quantitative. Constantly understanding the world around and the context around that customer better, the world, the market, competitors, right? Constantly refining their understanding of their mission and their product, and then all that leads to refining the product to basically be in sync with everything they've learned. The degree to which you can do that and the degree to which that cycle, that loop is tight, is the degree to which, you know, you can be a highly performing product organization.
So the faster you can gather that information, the faster you can iterate, that feedback loop is important.
100%, right? And the degree of which, you know, the degree of intelligence in your gathering of insight, how good the organization, how good the people who gather those insights are at understanding why what they're doing works, why what this person said what they said, right? The interpretive ability.
Let's talk about this in a little bit more detail, because I think research is probably one thing that, you know, at least from my experience on Designer News, is not something that's talked about. How are you guys doing research? Like, what are some of those tactics that you guys use to gather that intel?
No, like, they're traditional, explicit, let's say, organizationally siloed research practices, you know, things that the research department does. And then there are, I think, end up being often even more valuable, or they're valuable more often. It's different than, you know, it's slightly different nuance difference there. The ambient research that you encourage the product team, even at the individual contributor level, to do. How can you get a larger percentage of the people who design the things that end up being your product? How do you get them exposure to your customer? Now, we happen to be in a very rare, you know, unfair advantage in that, you know, the people who design our product happen to be designers, which you might imagine is an advantage. They think about it all the time. They use our product all day. They use our product to build our product. And so there's this great, you know, whatever. That becomes the bigger the product, the bigger our user base, and the more diverse our customer base becomes, the more difficult that is to rely on. And so then, you know, you have research excursions, you know, where you basically send people out to customers and they spend a lot of time just understanding why they do what they do. And those kind of like, you know, more deliberate things. You also have the more ambient and yet, you know, transactional things like just getting designers into customer support, having them plumb through customer support tickets, understand trends, have them actually answer support, which we don't do as much as we actually probably should, answer customer support tickets and understand the voice of the customer. Again, probably because we have this unfair advantage of just, you know, being the customer at the same time.
You know, one of the things that is I think also interesting about Envision is I'm trying to remember, you know, 5 years ago, what this marketplace, what the space was like. And I feel like product design and product designers, there really weren't a huge number of them, you know, until maybe like 5 years ago. Thinking back, I now see Azure and a bunch of these wireframing tools. How did you see yourself and Envision fitting into this space?
Yeah, so I've always had a cynicism against, and by the way, it's, you know, this might be politically incorrect for me to say on this, you know, this show, but I've always had a cynicism about wireframing tools. So I felt like you're not going to build the future with a toolbox of the past, right? With a set of, you know, interface widgetry, all the best apps in the world. And I think this is part of the thesis. You know, this is like probably my part of my original investor deck. All of the best apps in the world have user interface paradigms and design patterns that you will not find in any of X, Y, and Z products' little library of tools. So, you know, design is the language of interface design is evolving too rapidly for that to be the answer. Also, you had to be, if you're not high fidelity, you're in a world of abstraction. The more abstract you are, the more difficult it is to get regular rank and file archetypal customers, VPs of this, that, and the other, to understand what you're trying to design. If you and I mean, a little metaphor I use here, it's a metaphor, it's a story. If you and I sit down and we draw something on a napkin, we can have like a rocking conversation about that product idea. But if you go home and show that napkin to your roommate, to your wife, to your cousin, and just say, hey, bro, check this out. This is amazing. This is like the future of whatever, right?
This napkin's incredible.
Right, this napkin, this right. He will have no idea what that thing on that napkin is. Like, the things that we create in prototyping and design have two purposes. They're storytelling devices. They're the medium for a narrative about a product, a process, a workflow. And they traditionally have not been, but I think one of the things that Envision, you know, kind of added to the equation, they are also the assets required to design those things in the first place. Envision was the first design prototyping tool that wasn't a throwaway asset. You have to design those screens in Photoshop anyway. Sketch, right? Now people use Sketch, right? You know, you have to design those screens anyway. And now they have this additional life as this kinesthetic interactive storytelling device, right? That you can use to get feedback to refine the design, to refine the prototype, and there's this great virtuous cycle. Most prototyping tools prior to Envision, the asset, the prototype itself, became obsolete the minute you moved past the prototyping process. By the way, I have this really bad habit of not answering people's questions and just going off.
Well, I suppose the original question was, where do you guys see yourself in the marketplace?
He said, how do we solve both problems? How do we create something that's full fidelity, right? That really looks like the finished product, that feels like the finished product, people can actually see and look at and have real conversations about with almost anyone. It didn't rely on some amount of, you know, intimacy with the domain problem or whatever. And then how do we create something that, you know, ultimately will then get used for the production of the product, right? How do we create a new requirements document? So to us, these kind of prototypes were the new requirements documents. That was the original vision for the product as evolved.
And how did early customers respond to that? Was this something that when you showed them, like obviously it worked well for you guys, but when you started trying to go out and charge people for it, are they like, no, we're using this wireframe tool, or, you know, static files are fine?
The role, I think, shifted. Again, how much of this shift is still happening is because I think that, you know, product designer, person who uses Sketch and thinks deeply about product decisions, this has become like a fully articulated, you know, domain and role, and there are people who just do this. But that wasn't always the case. there were UX people who didn't design, who didn't use Photoshop or Sketch or whatever, who just thought about, there were UI people, there were people who lived in the world of wireframe. The Envision solution was for a totally different cohort of person. I would say we saw very little switch away from an Azure to an Envision. What we saw was the emergence of a totally new class of designer that started in Photoshop and wanted to get those additional superpowers, right, of being able to think more about product. They didn't move from Azure or Balsamic to Envision. They moved from Photoshop to Photoshop plus Envision.
Right. I mean, so the market, it was kind of a new market. It wasn't taking away from...
And, you know, obviously you can tie this into like the broader market theme that the screen has become the most important place in the world.
Sure, certainly.
Right. A fabulous, for some people, the entirety of your consumption happens in some way, either directly through that screen or assisted by that screen.
Well, people that work in, you know, work on software design are, you know, on the screen for both entertainment and work. So,
right. And your relationships, the you know, so many, I want to use less than absolute terms, but, you know, but I have my opinions about this. So many of the brands that you engage with and the people that you engage with, whether for personal, professional purposes, right? So many of those transactions, those interactions happen through the conduit of the screen, right? That screen has become the rubber meets the road point of contact between you and the rest of the world. You spend more time with on that screen than you do in any other physical place you occupy throughout the day. Designing for that screen, what happens on that screen, so two different dimensions, what happens on that screen has become of unimaginably paramount importance, right? For every brand in the world, right? Everyone whoever wants you to consume from them, what they put on that screen gets there is fundamentally shifting. So we see this like in we kind of divide the market in two different categories. There are big D companies and little D companies. Big D companies are, you know, the companies we like talking about the most. I won't name any, but, you know, the companies that lead with design, and design is part of their DNA, it's part of their go-to-market strategy to some degree, potentially, right? It's part, their organizations are constructed to be able to support design as a primary, you know, value in the organization. And then little D companies, these are the companies, they get design, they have design teams, but design hasn't emerged as a top-tier value center. What I think is interesting is that you could probably say that 99% of the addressable market for a company like Envision, and we have companies as super high design as X and as super low design as the Lotus Design agricultural, you know, farm equipment company you can imagine, right? Like super duper wide spectrum of customers. But like 99% of the addressable market are little D companies. Because little D companies today, many of them are aspirationally big D. They understand the individuals who power the design process, individuals who make design decisions, product managers, and there are people in those organizations who understand the value of design. They understand that at the end of the day, for many of them, there's this ballot box. There's this ballot. Imagine like a ballot, like you're voting in some states. And this ballot is like your screen in your hand. And there are like a billion people voting, tapping these little chads. The icons on your home screen are like chad. A quarter of an inch to the left, and you vote for Uber. A quarter of an inch, maybe less than a quarter, right, to the right, and you vote for Lyft. And like, just amortize that across like the billions of people in the world who are connected to the internet, right? We're all in this constant, if we're quiet enough, we can hear all the thumbs, right? Shifting markets based on the intention of the user. And that intention, some of it's rational, some of it's I get this and I like this. Much of it is experientially derived. Much of it is like my net aggregate experience with product A is on a scale from 1 to 5, 4.8. My net aggregate experience of pleasure, excitement, you know, fulfillment of whatever it is I came to accomplish practically, emotionally, whatever, right? With this other tool, with this other product, is 4.6. I never click 4.6 again. The evolutionary like model of, you know, human advancement, right? Just gets me, I move my thumb to the left and set it to the right now, right? And I click that app And in a frictionless world where anybody can download any app anytime, so obviously delivering discovery and, you know, market, you know, visibility has become like not a factor, right? You can download any app anytime. And so like app B just kind of floats to the second screen of your iPhone. And then you kind of like, why is this thing even here anymore? Right? And you just delete it. I don't need it. I delete it. And then I get a new phone and like it doesn't even end up there in the first place. And so if you understand that in a category, if your company A, B, C, and D all basically fighting for a slice of Sam's consumption, dollar spent, time spent,
emotions. It's a very important slice. Year,
right? It's a really duper, because that's the only slice they have, right? They have to go after that slice, that market category of Sam's consumption. So they're all, they recognize, I think most of them recognize that the incrementally better experience can win. Not only can it win, it can completely disrupt an entire industry. And that's why we call the movie Design Disruptors. Because design, a slightly, or I'm not even saying profoundly, because sometimes they're not profoundly better experiences, a slightly, marginally, significantly better experience can disrupt an entire market because your thumb went left instead of right, and it will never go right again. It will only click left.
So I want to ask you about two things, but there's one thing I just realized.
We're out of time 20 minutes ago. Yeah. That's what you realized.
we're out of time. So that's it. Clark Valberg, everybody. No. Clark, you guys are not really selling a product. You guys are selling a process.
Our product is also available for sale, just in case anybody's interested. No. No, 100%. 100%. And by the way, we're not even selling that process. The world is selling it for us, right? And this is like the big D, little D model. The little D, the whole world is looking to the big D company. Teach us how to build better products. Teach us how to leverage the power of design. Show us, you know, the process you guys use and the tools you use and the team that you've constructed. And we think about, you know, this market that we're developing here as basically three different dimensions. There are people, there are practices, and there's platform, right? And you could say this is true. This is like a whole big, you know, business conversation we can have another time. But, you know, you could think this is true for every market, by the way, you know, especially in the software world. This is true for all these top tier value centers that a business addresses, true for marketing, right? In marketing or in sales, what is the North Star platform in the sales domain today? Salesforce, Dr. Benioff. And we know that, so that's platform, right? We know that you need a certain you know, arrangement of certain kinds of people to have a successful sales organization. We know that you need practices, best practices, the latest and greatest practices, right? Time-tested practices. And you need to evolve your practices. So between the people and your arrangement of those people and those types of people, the practices those people employ and the platform those people use to be successful, that is a, let's call that a domain. That's a domain. So as we think about design, product, right? We think about better ways, and this our entire content strategy and everything you'll ever see from Envision is basically focused, you know, in terms of the marketing side of things, focused on helping the world know more about, right, what can make, you know, what makes these great companies with the products that we all love the most successful. What kind of people do they have? What do those people know that we don't know? What, you know, how do they arrange those people? How do we scale these teams and arrange these teams? What are their best practices? And arguably, you know, the what platforms and tools do they use to make it all happen?
The other thing I wanted to ask you about, going back to tapping one app over the other, choosing one company over the other, I feel like winning someone's attention might be a zero-sum game.
And that's why, by the way, I think statistics show there are like four apps you spend 80% of your time on your phone. I think it's actually more than that. By the way, I'm throwing out just wacky statistics here. Somebody's going to just Google. There's going to be like an addendum in the comments section on this podcast. Here are all the facts.
Fact check.
No, so like there is a crazy, you know, chasm between the few apps you use all the time and all the other stuff that's on your phone in terms of the attention that you give them. At the same time, each of these brands that aren't the one you use all the time have no choice but to look for ways to create better experiences, better product offerings, however you want to articulate it, right? To swim in to that number one spot or number two spot, swim up that chain.
Well, Clark, I think we're at about the 45-minute mark. So I think that's about all the time we have. It was fantastic talking with you.
I'm blowing a kiss to every person, every Designer News reader. By the way, I read Designer News 15 times a day.
Once again, my guest is Envision CEO and co-founder Clark Valberg. This is DNFM. All right, everyone, that's going to wrap it up for episode 10. If you enjoyed this show, make sure to subscribe. DNFM is on SoundCloud, iTunes, and you can always listen to the show online at designernews.co/podcast. Do you have ideas for making this show better? Please reach out on Twitter at @designernewsbot, or you can reach out to me personally. I'm at Samuel R. Solomon. If you're interested in supporting the show, please get in touch with us about sponsorship opportunities. Once again, my guest is Envision co-founder and CEO Clark Valberg. I'm Sam Solomon, and this is DNFM.